I'm going to shake this up, I can tell you. There's a big cultural change on the way.
Put down your binoculars, ladies and gentlemen. Malcolm has arrived.
I have two words for you. I'm back.
Together, we will make America great again.
The Wrap.
We're going to make The Wrap great again. It's Friday. Sean Kelly's with me. He's politics editor at The Monthly and a former advisor to Prime Ministers Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard. Hi, Sean.
Hey.
And up front and personal, right? Look, we can eyeball each other.
That's right.
That's right. I'm broadcasting from Sydney tonight. And Joe Lauder is a reporter for Triple J's Hack. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
So, Sean, what's drawn your attention this week?
Look, it's very hard for me, having lived through the tumult and torture of the Rudd-Gillard years, to look past climate change. it's affecting the other side of politics from the one that I was on. This has been a big week, and we should say it's potentially a big week for the nation if you can actually come to a landing point on climate policy, because whatever your politics, I think there's no doubt that this has bedeviled the country for a decade now, ever since Kevin Rudd and John Howard were dueling it out at the 2007 election. Here we are still going without a really settled policy to reduce climate and to put in place some certainty for the power industry. And so this has been a huge week. On Monday, you had Josh Frydenberg, the energy minister, using some coded language that has been widely interpreted as backing away from a clean energy target. Now, I should say, I do understand that pretty much everybody long ago switched off from any nuance between the clean energy target and an emissions intensity scheme and an emissions trading scheme or a carbon pollution reduction scheme or whatever the hell we're talking about this week. The important point to know is that it's a particular way of reducing emissions, that the chief scientist, Alan Finkel, recommended it back in June, that just after that, the Prime Minister came out. He didn't commit to delivering a clean energy target, but he did say he liked the idea, it had strong merit, and he would look on it favourably. Barnaby Joyce even came out and said he could be convinced. Labor complained a little, but then a few weeks later said we could be convinced to sign up to this as well. And so you had this potential for a grand bargain on climate. There was talk of ending the climate policy wars, but over the past few months, you've had the government slowly backing away from the clean energy target, and Monday gave us the strongest signal yet that that won't be the way the country's heading.
And of course, there was another angle to all of this. Speaking of climate change, this speech by former leader Tony Abbott at the Global Warming Policy Foundation in the UK, it made significant headlines this week. Let's just hear a bit of it.
Primitive people once killed goats to appease the volcano gods. We are much more sophisticated now, but are still sacrificing our industries and our living standards to the climate gods to little more effect.
Joe, what did you make of the speech?
I don't know what to make of that speech, to be honest. It's just, it's confusing. I think
he had me at goats.
Goats and volcanoes. I like how that fits into climate policy. I'm fascinated. But I think it kind of confirmed what we did all secretly think, what Tony Abbott believed about climate change. I don't think anyone ever really honestly believed it. But then that's confusing because what we're talking about with the clean energy target, this is to reduce our emissions so we can achieve a reduction that Tony Abbott signed us up to. So it's just, I have no idea. And I really question how much longer how he can still just go out there, go over to London and keep making comments like this. And I'm from the generation where the Kevin 07, that election was the first time I voted. And so I'm from a generation where this is all we've heard about in our whole kind of political life.
I'm so sorry on behalf of our country, if I can, you know, sorry that that's happened to you.
It's really depressing in a way, because it's like nothing really has changed. We're still debating the same things. We were told it was the greatest moral challenge of our time, and we kind of haven't really gone anywhere in a decade. And that's really sad.
Yeah, Sean, we're from a generation that watched all of it happen. I don't know if I want to be with Joe or just sticking with our kind of people. We're more similar in age. But what do you make of that, the intervention by Tony Abbott? Because I reckon Julie Bishop's rebuke has been really interesting. I mean, she's tried to point out that he's had a gazillion positions.
And she's absolutely right, of course. Bernard Keene at Crikey gathered all of them this week. I think there were 17 different clear positions that Tony Abbott has had on climate change over the years. And it's a bit distressing to watch that evolution. But one of the interesting things you have to say about Tony Abbott, a couple of people made this point during the week, is that he has played an almost unimaginably massive role in driving the climate change debate in this country. For somebody who, given his 17 different positions, doesn't seem to have a lot of actually substantive interest in climate change, in climate policy, doesn't seem to have a conviction on it, he has actually driven this from 2009, when he took the leadership from Malcolm Turnbull, ensured that Kevin Rudd's emissions trading scheme would be defeated, to his carbon tax campaign against Julia Gillard, to getting rid of the carbon tax in government, to the position he's playing in Malcolm Turnbull's government right now. He has been immensely dominant.
He has absolutely been immensely dominant, and really, you can't help but look at the climate wars without looking at it through the prism of Tony Abbott and that's his interventions.
But it's not just climate either. It's same-sex marriage at the moment. I feel like every morning you wake up and it's so much of the news is what's Tony Abbott's opinion on something.
I think that's right. And this, it pinpoints a wider political problem for Malcolm Turnbull's government, that I think a lot of people are disappointed in Malcolm Turnbull, but I also think a lot of people maintain some hope. And you can see that in some of the personal approval polling that is done on the Prime Minister. But the problem for any government is that it's not all about the Prime Minister. And I think certainly what happened to Labor in 2013 is that voters just gave up on Labor.
Yeah.
It stopped being about particular individuals, about whoever was leading the party. They just went, we cannot deal with this mess anymore. And that is what Tony Abbott is doing to the Liberal Party right now.
It's interesting you talked about that kind of semi-retreat. I mean, you know, there's a lot of ways to analyse it, but on the potential clean energy target, because it was also Josh Frydenberg as Energy and Environment Minister who this week, I thought, significantly backed the government's belief in climate change science.
Yes.
It's more nuanced than just that, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think Josh Frydenberg and Malcolm Turnbull probably do want to do something reasonably significant and reasonably plausible on climate. And we shouldn't forget that we'll get lost in the differences between these policies, but not that long ago, Josh Frydenberg did flag the possibility of an emissions intensity scheme, which is probably a slightly stronger policy than a clean energy target. And he was monstered for that, and the government ended up retreating on it. So I don't think it's fair to say that either Josh Frydenberg or Malcolm Turnbull are not serious about this policy. But I do think you are seeing a retreat from where they were. What you're hearing out of the government now is that there will be a policy. On Tuesday, we were told it would be in the next fortnight. By today, that had firmed up to probably on Monday or Tuesday. So Malcolm Turnbull knows he can't afford to let this linger. We're being told, you know, on background through sources and the newspapers and whatnot, that it will have an emphasis on affordability, on reliability, but that it will do something on emissions as well. And getting the balance between those three things correct is what Malcolm Turnbull will be focusing his energy on.
If you're just tuning in, this is RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvelis, and we're wrapping up the news week with my guests, Sean Kelly, the Monthly's politics editor, and Joe Lauder, who's from Triple J. Joe, let's move on to your big story of the week. And we've already covered it tonight. That's how big a story it is. In fact, we've covered it a couple of times this week because it's massive. And this is the Harvey Weinstein story, the sexual harassment allegations. And really what has happened is that Hollywood has been plunged into chaos and turmoil. What do you make of the way that this story has played out? It's like there's everyone's got an opinion, and now all of a sudden all these actors, including a lot of female actors, have had to come out and declare their positions.
Yeah, they have. But also I think it's really caught people up because, I mean, it's Hollywood, you know, there's all the glitz, the glamour, the power and the wealth, but also just the names. It seems like nobody in Hollywood is untouched by this scandal. And I think it's in this way, it kind of, it goes to that point that, and a lot of people I know have been making this point that, you know, sexual harassment, sexual assault is rife. No industry is immune. But I think there's also that dynamic at play when it comes to just such huge power and wealth. And I think that's really, you can't avoid it. And I think also it just points to how much you need, how much overwhelming evidence you need, and how much it takes to take down really powerful people and powerful men like this. Like, I know someone texted in earlier talking about Donald Trump, but Harvey Weinstein, I mean, not to excuse that video, the Hollywood All Access one about, you know, grabbing them by the pussy, but this is decades and decades worth of evidence. And like I said, it seems like nobody was untouched by it. And it was just allowed to happen for so long. And I think there's, without victim blaming, but there are a lot of people that probably have to answer for this. And I think the companies that he fronted and that he worked for, they have a lot to answer for, because it seems like now, you know, they've been so quick to fire him and to denounce Harvey Weinstein. But it seems like they've known about this for decades and nothing has happened.
Sean, do you think it makes a difference when celebrities speak out against this? And why do you think they didn't for so long?
I think it absolutely makes a difference. I think that it empowers people, and I don't just mean women who are prey to these types of attacks, but men who hear about these attacks as well, to actually do something about it. I think, more to the point, it puts a lot of, because it can often be very, very, very difficult if you're not in a position of power to act, and especially I think as a woman not in a position of power to act. But what it does do is put pressure on senior executives who hear about things like this to act. And I think, to Joe's point, that's why it's very, very important in this case that it's not just Harvey himself who has to pay for this. Actually, you need to have senior executives pay for this, because there is no doubt that they knew. There is no earthly way that there was not knowledge at senior levels of important, powerful organisations, be it the Weinstein Company or other Hollywood companies, who knew about this, knew either in detail or had heard vague rumours and did nothing about it. And by cracking down on them, by shaming them, a message can be sent to executives at other companies, and that's important.
I think it's a really interesting point, because it's easy to make Weinstein... He falls, but everyone else can survive. When
and there'll
it's actually
be another
a cultural cover-up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other really frustrating thing with this is his lawyer came out when this first came to light. The lawyer made a statement, and it said in part of it, it had this line, that he's reading books and he's going to therapy, that he's an old dinosaur learning new ways. And I just, like, that's not an excuse. Like, it's not a generational thing that it was okay to, you know, to assault people, to grope women, to harass people. And, like, that, I think that generational thing, I think that kind of downplays it in a way when it just shouldn't be.
I think that's right. And Gia Tolentino wrote a great piece in The New Yorker, I'd recommend it to everybody, in which she makes really clear that what the behaviour you're seeing here was deliberate victimization of young women, who wouldn't have the chance to speak back, of young women who wouldn't necessarily have the power or the experience to be able to do something about it. And when that's happening, you know it's not about dinosaurs, because he could have picked on somebody his own size and he didn't. And that tells you everything you need
to
know.
And it's really, it's not brain surgery about why those women were so vulnerable. This whole, why didn't some of those women speak out? I've heard that as well.
Oh.
Well, you know what? You've spent your entire life working towards being cast in a film.
Yep.
You've got access to the most powerful man who can make you famous, and that's all you've ever wanted to do. And you're going to somehow have an equal kind of platform as him to sort of stare him down and then still thrive in the industry? Get real, right?
100%.
And there's such vulnerability as well. I know with the model and actress Cara Delevingne, when she was talking about her experience, she said, you know, she was in the room and then he started talking really explicitly about her sexual preferences and whether or not she's bisexual, and was trying to get her to do things. And she was so intimidated that she said she just stood up and started to sing and was like, oh, do you know I'm also a singer, and tried to turn it around. And you just really feel for them. Like, there's just this universal vulnerability there. Like, it's, yeah, he's just preys on, you know, people who are just, where there's an absolute power imbalance.
Let's move to some of the other stories that you guys have noticed and want to share. Sean, recently there's been a spat between the US and Cuba after about 22 American diplomats.
Yeah, this is fascinating.
They got headaches, they got ear problems. What's wrong with these guys?
It's a bit of a mystery. They started hearing a strange sound, and you can find it online. Whether you want to take that risk yourself is up to you. It's kind of a high-pitched whine. I describe it as at the upper register of a cicada's hum. And these American embassy personnel started experiencing, yes, headaches, but loss of hearing, loss of memory as well, cognitive impairment. It's been described as minor brain damage, and nobody really knows what's going on. A couple of mysteries. The first is, who's doing this? Obvious answer being the Cuban government. The US government hasn't come out and accused them directly, but the chief of staff to the White House has said, we believe that the Cuban government could stop this from happening, which is an interesting comment. Doesn't mean that he's implicating the Cuban government at all. The second big question is, comes around this sound, because nobody actually knows of a sound that could create the types of physical impairments we're seeing. And so in the last couple of days, you've had neuroscientists coming out and saying, well, we're a bit iffy on this sonic weapon, sonic attack theory. We think maybe actually what we're seeing is mass hysteria, a small group of people working very intensely together under a lot of stress, under a lot of pressure, actually just become very susceptible, very suggestible. So we don't know what's going on. It is having actual consequences for Cuban-American relations, but it remains a mystery.
It's so, after you brought this to our attention, I started reading crazily about it. Now I'm completely obsessed. Thank you.
Me too.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating because there's so many of them.
Yeah.
They can't be all making it up, or it's they can't all number. Be hysterical, can they?
Maybe.
I suppose they could.
Maybe.
And you'd think diplomats are quite resilient as well. Like, I feel like they're screened for these kinds of things, like that they can, I don't know, withstand this.
I'm not going to comment on their resilience. I suppose it depends what other things they've done in their lives. Joe, Nick Xenophon included some sheep or rams in a protest earlier this week. Now, we know he's the, like, stunt man, right? He
Absolutely.
Wants to leave the federal parliament and really deal with more stunts in South Australia.
Have they
not seen enough stunts, these people? But more stunts for them. What was he doing?
Oh, look, this caught my attention because it's not, so this is a dispute. I'll go from the beginning. It's a dispute about Ugg boots. Fascinating, classically Australian. So about the trademark over the word Uggs for Ugg boots. And so apparently the American company Deckers owns the right to the name overseas. And so Australian companies can't sell Ugg boots and call them Ugg boots in America. And like, I'm not one for, you know, international trademark disputes or whatever, but I just love the fact that, you know, if you have props and if you have stunts included in your protest, I'm just all about it. And so Nick Xenophon went over to LA outside the company's headquarters with about a dozen sheep and tried to release them out the front and like stage this protest. And so, of course, you have sheep, you have LA, you know, there's some sheep running out on the main road and it just goes totally crazy. And I love that. I love it when it goes wrong.
The man is shameless.
I want to know where he got the sheep. Did he hire them? Did he say, I'm going to...
Are they Australian-produced sheep?
Yeah.
I have no
this
idea.
This needs a wider investigation for sure. All right, recommendations. We're going into the weekend, right? And we need to do stuff with our weekend. If you haven't got anything planned, Joe, what should we do?
I'm actually going to be listening to the new podcast that everyone's been telling me about that I haven't got onto yet called Dirty John. So it's produced by the LA Times and... shameless humble brag, I'm going to be on an international flight. So I'm just going to be binging, I think, on this podcast.
Humble brag, I'm just traveling.
Humble brag,
I'm
I get to.
Young
yeah,
and happy.
This is my last thing
I get
to
around.
Do. Going to Mexico. But yeah, so I'm going to be binging, I think, on this and then also just on really, really cheesy rom coms that are on the plane that aren't Weinstein produced.
Yeah, that's definitely. Yeah, no Weinstein rom coms. Mm-hmm. Hey, what is Dirty John about?
So everyone's telling me it's a true crime podcast. Apparently it's the new serial because, you know, that's the slogan to sell any podcast these days.
It's the new serial.
Yeah. So, but it's about a successful middle-aged interior designer. And so she meets this guy called John on online dating and he seems like the perfect match. He's this, you know, all-American hunk and things just start to unravel. And so that's where I'm going to leave it because I haven't listened.
No, you haven't, so you can't. But that is it's an interesting premise. Are you into these kind of true crime?
No, not really.
Not your thing?
No.
True sort of political crime, really.
Well,
you like watching
true,
in real life in
true.
Canberra.
Clean energy crime.
It is like a clean energy crime. Joe, you've just won the radio prize for the night. Sean, what should we do?
Recommendation?
Yeah, what should we do with our weekend?
What should we do to surrender to Joe's prize?
Yeah.
I just finished reading this week a book by Maggie Nelson. She is an American author. She's an American poet as well, and an academic. And I should say her writing is a bit academic, and it should be more academic because there's a lot of cultural theory in there. That's not an instruction to Maggie Nelson, who's a genius. What I mean
My
is...
My advice to you, Maggie.
You go into this book thinking this is going to be a difficult read, and it's not at all. It's about birth, love, death. It's about her relationship with the transgender artist Harry Dodge. It's about her experiences with IVF. It's an incredibly moving book. She looks at every one of those ideas and experiences very, very hard and very carefully. It's a very short book. It's beautiful and thought-provoking, and I recommend it to you all.
So beautifully too. You're clearly passionate about this book.
It was a really good book, and I guess I felt reading it in the middle of this marriage plebiscite when there are a lot of arguments being dragged out. No, tell me about it. That it's a very important time to be thinking about identity, and this book is to a very large extent about identity.
It's funny you raised that. We've only got a couple of minutes till the news, but I've noticed, and I'd love to get both of your thoughts. I know Triple J obviously does a bit of a focus on this, Joe, because a lot of young people are very interested in this issue. But Sean, I know you write about things extensively, but has the marriage debate died?
Does feel like it in the
last
week.
Feels dead to me.
2 weeks ago, I wrote a piece about how much it was dominating national debate. The next week, the stories had just dropped off a bit, and this week, it feels like it's barely been touched at all. But I tell you what, I reckon as you approach the final deadline for ballots, we're going to see it ramp up again.
I feel like it died down once we heard the statistics that there were the votes that had been returned were overwhelmingly yes. But I will say I was having lunch this week and I thought it was over and I haven't heard many people talk about it, but above me in the sky, there was a giant bubble writing font. No.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of the only time it's come up, I think, this week.
The bubble writing was quite contentious too. That's the main
Poor font
interest
choice.
I took.
It was suspenseful because the way they drew the lines for the N, it took a while. We were like, where are they?
I was like,
noughts and crosses.
I saw your picture of it.
Yeah, nice picture, wasn't it?
Very artistic.
Yeah, that's me.
Blue sky.
I'm arty. I thought it died too, and I thought that was my political analysis. I bet you agree because it's that obvious. My political analysis is that it was the No campaign's way of trying to get it back on the agenda. To be honest, because it is in their interests, I think, to get this back on the agenda.
I mean, they need another controversy. That's what the No campaign has been very good at during the last month. They've been very good at generating controversy, whether it's the official campaign or Tony Abbott or Corey Bernardi, and they haven't had one in a while. They probably need one.
I've seen some crowdfunding for a yes skywriting, so maybe that's what they need.
More skywriting. If they use bubble writing, I love it.
No,
I'm just into bubble
alone.
Writing. Bubble no, writing. Yes. My 8-year-old just loves bubble writing and I'm with her. Like, I've never seen anyone write with bubble writing as much as that kid. Thank you both of you. It's been great having you in. Sean Kelly is at The Monthly and a former advisor to Prime Minister's Right. And Gillard Joe Lauder is a reporter with Triple J's Hack. This is RN Drive. It's 7 News Time.